Well, welcome. We have people in the back room building an ark. I'd like to introduce Professor Christopher Manfredi, who's the University Provost and also Vice Principal Academic. He was appointed this past July. Before that, he was Dean of Arts. And he will deliver the official welcome on behalf of McGill University.
Thank you very much, Joe. I've learned at least one very important thing tonight, which is that the combination of pouring rain, newly soled leather shoes, and marble floors are an almost lethal combination. I want to welcome all of you here tonight to the Trottier Public Science Symposium, which is one of McGill's premier events that takes place every year. These days, thinking about and evaluating scientific issues is more crucial than ever. There are questions about global warming, chemicals in our environment, electromagnetic radiation, the relative effectiveness of conventional and alternative health care, and the quality of our diet. My own discipline of political science had its own scandal in this area this year when a very high-profile study published in Science magazine had to be withdrawn because it turned out the data on which it was based had been completely fabricated. Answers to that type of issue and these other questions that I've mentioned should be based on evidence, but as we will hear tonight and tomorrow night, evidence is open to interpretation and more often than not hyped by the media. McGill University has always taken pride in being a leader in education, not only for our students, but for the public at large as well. And McGill's Office for Science and Society is a world leader in terms of communicating science to the public. The OSS has a mandate to demystify science, to ensure that people are up to date on what is happening in the world of science, to foster critical thinking, and to separate sense from nonsense. This is exactly aligned with Lauren Trottier's vision in promoting scientific thinking and why he has so generously committed to ongoing support of the OSS, and we thank Lauren for his support for this endeavor as well as several others within the university. I'd now like to introduce our moderator for this evening, who is Dr. Joe Schwartz. I think no one well to many of you, but I will introduce him in any event. He is the director of the Office for Science and Society. He is well known for his informative and entertaining public lectures on topics ranging from the chemistry of love to the science of aging. Those two must be connected somehow. Dr. Schwartz has received numerous awards for teaching chemistry and for interpreting science for the public. Most recently, he was awarded the Robert P. Ballas Annual Prize in Critical Thinking, presented by the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry for his book, Is That a Fact? You can hear him Sunday afternoon on CJAD's The Dr. Joe Show, and he's appeared hundreds of times on television. He's the author of 15 bestsellers, with his most recent, Monkeys, Myths, and Molecules, out last May. His 16th book is already in the works. Let me welcome Dr. Joe to the stage. He'll get us started.
Well, welcome, everyone. There's seats in the front here for those of you who are kind of stuck in the back. You know, there was a professor who was looking out at a large class, and he wanted to make a point, a scientific point. And he walks over to this side, and he picks up a bottle with a wriggling live worm in it, and he shows it to the students and pours in a bit of alcohol. The worm dies. He goes over, picks up another bottle with a wriggling live worm in it, pours in a little bit of chocolate syrup. The worm dies. Picks up a third bottle with a living worm in it, wriggling all over the place, pours in a little bit of tobacco juice, and the worm dies. and looks out at the students and says, "What do you make of that?" And one guy in the back says, "Sir, sir, I know. If you drink, smoke, and eat chocolate, you don't have to worry about worms." There's a point to that story, of course, and the point is that he made the right observation but came to the wrong conclusion. And science, of course, is all about making observations and coming to conclusions. And basically, that's what we call evidence, isn't it? You make an observation, and you want to see, what does this really mean? It's not simple to come up with a definition for evidence, because it isn't white or black, it is many shades of gray. Something that is judged to be good evidence by one person may be judged to be weak by someone else. Nevertheless, I think we all have sort of an overall feeling for what evidence is. It's anything that really provides proof to back up an assertion that one might make. Well, tonight we're going to look at two separate controversial issues and see where the evidence leads us, which is the path that we should take because of the evidence in front of us. We're going to take a look, first of all, at radiation that is caused by cell phones, and after that we'll look at the fascinating problem of genetic modification. And as is our usual tendency with these symposia, we invite world-class speakers to address the Montreal public and our students on these issues. And last night we had Paul Offit from Philadelphia talk to us about vaccination, together with Brian Ward, who's one of our local experts. And today we're switching gears, of course, and we're going to address the two issues that I just mentioned to you. So first, I would like to introduce the cell phone topic. And our speaker here comes to us from New York City, from the Albert Einstein School of Medicine. Jeffrey Cabot is an epidemiologist. And epidemiologists look at disease patterns and try to unravel the mystery of what causes that disease. So we are, I think we are in a treat. Dr. Cabot has research interests in all kinds of areas, especially in the area of cancer and what kind of things cause cancer. He writes regularly for Forbes magazine. You can read him on the web. So I would like to invite Dr. Cabot to come up and see if we can unravel the mystery of radiation cell phones and what they do or do not do to us.
I'm delighted to be here tonight, and I want to thank Joe Schwartz for inviting me to this really exemplary public science symposium. I also want to thank Lauren Trottier for making the symposium possible, and I want to thank Emily Shore for doing a superb job making all of the arrangements that brought Kevin and Paul Offit and myself from distant parts. Before I proceed, I guess I should say something about conflicts of interest. And this didn't occur to me until Joe suggested that I make a statement about it, but I realized immediately how totally appropriate it is when you're talking about something, a topic like this, to lay on the line what your potential conflicts of interest are. I've never received any funding for any work on cell phones or Wi-Fi. I did do research on very low frequency EMF, electromagnetic fields, about 15 years ago at Stony Brook, and those studies were funded by the National Cancer Institute. Contrary to what some of the readers of articles that I've written on Forbes about cell phones and other topics, contrary to and unhappily, I do not receive any money for writing those articles. They're done out of whatever other motivation, love and interest and so forth. Okay. The spread of cell phone technology and of wireless technology generally over the past two decades is surely one of the most dramatic innovations in the history of technology and has transformed our lives, the lives of many people, particularly in inaccessible areas of the world, and it is also having a wide range of effects on all of us, and particularly on children who start using these devices at an early age. If this technology is now used by billions of people worldwide is capable of causing catastrophic adverse health effects, this is terribly important for us to know. So this issue raises a number of questions in the most urgent way. For example, what is the evidence? The topic of this symposium. How good is the evidence? Is some evidence more important than other evidence? How far does the evidence take us in answering the question? And what should we do when the evidence has limitations? A couple of further remarks are in order by way of introducing my talk. When a scientific question like the health effects of radio frequency or energy or RF energy gets thrust into the public arena, it becomes a social phenomenon as well as a scientific question. And this opens the door to all sorts of extra scientific influences and agendas that feed back on the science and can greatly confuse the issue. So my interest in the cell phones question is in examining the complex interplay between science and society on this issue. A couple of further remarks are in order. In 2009, the well-known epidemiologist Kenneth Rothman, who did one of the earliest studies of cell phones, wrote a commentary in which he said the following: "The safety of mobile telephones is a pressing question now that the brains of nearly half the humans on the planet have become exposed within a short span of time to a physical agent to which their ancestors' genes could not have adapted." So how did the question of the health effects of cell phones arise in the first place and become a burning issue? In 1992, the wife of a man in St. Petersburg, Florida, a man named David Renard, died of a fatal brain cancer at the age of 34. And Renard went on Larry King Live in January of 1993, and he said, "She held the cell phone against her head and she talked on it all the time." And he was impressed by the fact that the tumor appeared on the same side as that on which she held the cell phone. Now, the tumor has roughly a 50% chance of being on more on one side or the other side, so just to mention that. And he further said, made the comment, "The tumor was exactly in the pattern of the antenna." So I would submit that this event, this very public event, I don't know how many tens of millions of people saw the Larry King live show, but this had an enormous impact. But here we are in the realm of magical thinking rather than this is really what anthropologists wrote about in the Trobriand and Islanders and so on. It's not scientific thinking, it's religious or pre-scientific thinking. So let's look at the two phenomena that are being linked. Epidemiology studies associations, and you have on the one hand an exposure that you're interested in, and on the other hand a disease or a health state that you're interested in. Let's look at the at brain cancer and the exposure in question. Brain cancer is a very rare disease. There are approximately 13,000 cases in men occurring in the United States each year, and approximately 10,000 cases in women, estimated for the year 2005. For comparison, there are roughly 230,000 cases of prostate cancer each year, and roughly an equal number of cases of breast cancer diagnosed each year. So brain cancer represents between 1 and 2% of all cancer. And very little is known about what causes brain cancers. Ionizing radiation is capable of causing brain cancer, and certain rare hereditary syndromes are associated with brain cancer, but these account for a very, very small percentage of cases, and we don't know what the more important causes are. Now let's look at the agent in question, namely radio frequency energy. This slide shows the electromagnetic spectrum, and to orient you, on the left-hand side we have X-rays, we have gamma rays, cosmic rays, we have X-rays, we have ultraviolet light, and we have light in the visible spectrum, and at the opposite end, with the lowest frequency, and therefore the lowest energy, we have 60 hertz radiation EMF from power lines, and long radio waves, and cell phones over the past 20 years have used various frequencies in this range, in the radio wave and the microwave region of the spectrum. So the point is that the energy, the frequency and the energy associated with this portion of the spectrum is millions of times lower than this area, which is referred to as ionizing radiation. And ionizing radiation can knock an electron out of an atom or molecule, therefore creating an ion. And ionization can lead to cancer. Damage to the DNA via due to ionization can lead to cancer. This is well established. So the main point here is that RF needs to be distinguished from ionizing radiation. It's also relevant to note, sort of historically, that the concern about the health effects of RF energy came along in 1993 or so, just as the 15-year very intense scare over EMF, electromagnetic fields from power lines and other sources, electrical appliances, was tapering off, was running out of steam. Now, standards for human exposure to RF have been in effect for decades. And these are based on microwaves. Microwaves do have effects at high power levels, and the principal effect is heating, and as we know from microwave ovens. And so the standards that are set by the FCC, but it's based on organizations like the IEEE, the Electrical Engineering Group, and the what's called ICNIRP. There's a Commission on Non-Ionizing Radiation, and so forth, that have approved this standard. It's based on the assumption that below the level at which heating occurs, you're not going to get biological effects, and this involves quite a margin below the level at which heating occurs. Okay, when it comes to cell phones, so RF energy is weak, cannot break bonds, and there's no known mechanism by which this type of radiation can induce or promote cancer. When it comes to cell phones, the exposure depends on a number of things. First of all, the characteristics of the phone. Second, and importantly, the distance of the antenna from the person, the user's head, and the strength of the signal to or from the nearest base station. And so the point is that this is a difficult exposure to measure in the types of studies we do, and regularly the questions that we ask are the things listed here. Do you use a cell phone regularly? At what age did you start using it? How often do you use it? What's the average length of the calls you make? How many years of use, which can be calculated? And what side of the head, your head, do you hold, on which side do you hold the cell phone? That's typically what we have. And so epidemiologic studies have been used to address the question, is there an association between cell phone use and the developing brain tumors? And the main type of study that's been carried out is the case control study. In this kind of study, one enrolls cases diagnosed with the disease of interest and then selects a comparison, or as you go along, you select a comparison group known as a control group. One collects information from the participants on the exposures of interest, but there's a problem. There are several problems with this type of study. And scientists are well aware of these problems. First, we're asking people to remember their use of cell phones going back a decade or 15 years or more. And we all know how hard it is just to remember what we did last week. Second, cases may report their use of cell phones differently from controls, and this for two reasons. Cases have a motivation to come up with an explanation for why they developed this terrible disease. In addition, brain cancer often affects cognition and memory, and by virtue of that alone, it can affect the answers, independent of what the true exposure is. And this phenomenon is referred to as recall bias, because it's a difference between the cases and the controls in the information you're getting. Now, the results of a number of epidemiologic studies appeared in the latter part of the 1990s and the early 2000s, and these generally found no association. But other studies were in the works, particularly the large 13-country Interphone study carried out under the auspices of the International Agency for Research on Cancer, known by its acronym IARC. And the results of the Interphone study were published in 2010, and the study included approximately 5,000 brain tumor patients and 5,000 controls. And the main types of tumor were meningioglioma, which is a malignant brain cancer, and meningioma, which is a largely benign tumor. And the data collection was undertaken between 2000 and 2004. However, the results were not published until 2010, 6 years after the end of data collection. And it is quite clear that it was extremely difficult for the 48 authors involved in the project in 13 different countries to reach a consensus and to agree on how to interpret the results. This slide from the Interphone study is the first breakdown of data that they give. There are a number of tables. This is sort of the key summary table. Meningioma is the panel on the left. Glioma, can you see this at all? It's sort of fuzzy, I'm sure. So I'll tell you what's going on here. Glioma results are on the right. Okay. The results were really surprising to everyone involved because regular cell phone use showed an inverse association with risk of both types of tumors. And that is to say, the risk estimate, instead of being above 1, was below 1. And not only that, it was statistically significantly below 1, okay? So for meningioma, if you were a regular user of a cell phone, you had a 21% reduced risk. I mean, that's what it looks like. And for glioma, a 19% reduced risk, okay? Now, when you look at cumulative call time with no hands-free devices and cumulative number of calls, you also, for the most part, see reduced risks, okay? There is only one positive result in all of the data shown in this table, and that is here. So if someone had more than 1,640 hours of cumulative call time, okay, then they had a 40% increased risk of developing glioma. Nothing significant for meningioma, although slightly elevated. Okay, so, all right. But look at the other groups. Look at the second highest group. There you have a statistically significant 29% reduction in your risk of developing glioma. The important thing here is look at all of the data, and the important thing is that there is absolutely no suggestion of a trend in these data. And furthermore, what is a 40% increase? A 40% increase is quite a modest increase. to compare it to smoking and lung cancer. If these were data for smoking and lung cancer, and these were half packs of cigarettes or something, you would see that smokers of any kind had a tenfold increased risk. That's an 1,000% increase. There's a 40% increase. And you would see going up into the higher reaches, we had people in our studies who smoked five packs of cigarettes a day. You would see relative risks going up to 60-fold easily. And so the point is, this is a sort of a blip, appears to be a blip, and the fact that, and one shouldn't make too much of it. Now, there's another set of studies, and so the Interphone conclusion was, overall, no increase in the risk of glioma or meningioma was observed with use of mobile phones. There were suggestions of an increased risk of glioma at the highest exposure levels. I'm not sure why that's plural. The highest level, period, but biases and error prevent a causal interpretation. This is what the best, this is what they came up with after 6 years of, struggling to reach a consensus. Okay, there's another group of studies, and these are from Sweden, and they come from a group led by an oncologist named Lennart Hardell, and he's published a number of case control studies, and the point about his studies is he finds larger effects or larger associations, and for example, in contrast to what we just saw in the Interphone study, he sees an association, 30% increased risk for ever users or for regular users of cell phones, and he particularly sees a big increase, threefold increased risk for long-term users, whereas we saw not very much going on in the Interphone study. He also finds an effect of the side of the head on which you hold the phone. Okay. But I've got to tell you that people are very skeptical about that question, because it turns out that cell phone users are not very reliable in telling you, in recounting what side of the head they hold the phone on, and especially once they have a brain tumor that may interfere with the accuracy of their reporting. The methodology of these studies has been questioned, and Hardell's results are really considered to be an outlier. In other words, no one can really explain how you could get results like that asking the same questions as are asked in the bulk, the vast majority of epidemiologic studies. I'll come back to these studies in a minute. Because of the problems inherent in case control studies, it is important to refer to evidence from another type of study. This is what is called a cohort study or a prospective study or longitudinal study. In this type of study, one enrolls a healthy population and obtains information about the exposure of interest. And one then follows the cohort for a number of years to see who develops disease. This type of study design eliminates the problem of participation bias and recall bias. Now, basically, one such study of any size has been conducted, and it's a nationwide study in Denmark, which enrolled 358,000 mobile phone subscribers who have been followed in the late 1980s, and has followed them for 18 years, and their health outcomes were compared to those of non-subscribers, because in Denmark and the Scandinavian countries, they have nationwide cancer registries for the whole population. So the incidence of brain tumors was assessed over time. This study used billing information from the telecommunications provider to estimate exposure, unlike in the case control studies, rather than using subjective reports, thus avoiding the problems of recall bias. And this study found no hint of any association either for regular use or for long-term use of a cell phone, either in men or in women. And it's periodically updated. They're continuing to follow this population. Now, there's another type of evidence. Okay, no hint of any association. There's another type of evidence that rarely gets the attention it deserves. Over the past 20 years, cell phone use has skyrocketed in the U.S. and elsewhere from zero subscriptions to over 300 million subscribers. Now, this is shown in the upper panel. The lower panel shows brain cancer incidence rates over a 30-year period ending in 2006. And what one sees is that the rates are absolutely flat. And there's more recent data are available. I wanted to match the two timescales, but more recent data are available from many countries and in Scandinavia, in the United States, in Australia, and in other countries. There is basically no evidence of any substantial increase in brain cancer rates. Although these data are correlational, they actually convey a strong message. Activists argue that not enough time has elapsed for the full effect of cell phone use to become apparent. And there's some truth to this. There's definitely truth to this. Nevertheless, given the dramatic increase that we see in the exposure, there is reason to expect some indication of an increase in cancer rates, particularly in the younger age groups. Early increases in lung cancer in men were seen in the decades following World War I, when cigarette smoking took off among males in the United States. And things in biology, they don't happen like this. You don't hit a wall and go up or down. Things tend to, these relationships tend to be gradual. In addition to epidemiologic studies, there is an extensive body of experimental studies that have been carried out over many years. Dozens of long-term animal studies have assessed the effects of RF on cancer in whole animals, and these studies have been largely negative. Now, these are important, and they're important because here you can expose test animals, rodents, to a defined type of radiation for a defined period of time, and it can be pulsed, and it can be, you know what exactly, so you can test different hypotheses. And so it adds something to the evidence that these studies are negative. There are also lots of other studies which are much harder to interpret. Gene expression, studies in cells, and so on. Now the activist movement has tended to latch on to positive results and ignore the totality of the evidence. And this movement has also latched on to the results from Lennart Hardell, and he's viewed as a champion by the activists. And this highlighting of only the positive results is a textbook exhibit of how not to evaluate the science. And the activists feel that there's evidence that a real hazard is being ignored, and they call for tighter regulation and invoke the precautionary principle. And they appear to have a very deep-seated distrust. Now, it's reasonable to have a healthy distrust for industry and the government. I mean, just look at Volkswagen incident of last week. But that doesn't mean that cell phones are causing brain cancer. And this deeply felt distrust distorts their ability to look at the evidence. Because these studies, contrary to popular belief, these studies are not being manipulated by government or industry. Finally, I should say that I learned when I wrote some journalistic pieces on this topic, if you try to present the evidence objectively, you can get attacked in the most brutal way. And the intensity of belief and the feelings that people have on an issue like this are quite remarkable. And the activists use lurid images to suggest that RF is penetrating deep into the brain and having catastrophic effects. Okay, I've given you an overview of the evidence. I'm not going to rehash this slide, but all of these different types of evidence basically provide nothing solid, strong, or consistent, or convincing to indicate that there is a relationship. Now I want to turn to the latest twist in the RF story. In May 2011, the IARC, the International Agency, issued a press release that was followed by a short paper declaring that in view of the limited evidence in humans and in experimental animals, the working group classified RF as, quote, possibly carcinogenic in humans, putting it in the 2B, in their 2B group. Now, this announcement left me and quite a number of other people scratching their heads. IARC is a venerable institution that's been assessing carcinogenic hazards for the past 40 years. And the 2B group, possible carcinogen, has approximately 260 agents in it. They're mainly chemicals, but it also includes coffee and DDT. And let me tell you that coffee and DDT have been studied in my discipline epidemiologically in dozens and dozens and dozens of studies. And there is no convincing evidence that they cause cancer. And furthermore, actually, coffee is fairly impressively associated with reduced risk of some cancers, for example, endometrial cancer. So if anything, coffee may be doing us good, news which probably isn't getting out to a wider population. But beyond this, there were irregularities in the decision process, in the IARC process. And what I'm referring to is two epidemiologists either quit or, in one case, were dismissed from the committee. And this enhanced, Lennart Hardell was a member of this committee. In other words, he was sitting in this group of 15 or so experts, and he was voting on his own work. A strange situation. So the fact that two epidemiologists peeled away from the committee enhanced his stature and his voice. Furthermore, after reviewing all of the evidence which I've mentioned, the epidemiology, cells, whole animal studies, mechanistic studies, the committee was instructed to vote only on the epidemiology, ignoring all the other studies. This is very strange because there are other cases in which IARC judges things to be, puts them in a certain category where there is no human evidence or no adequate human evidence, and they use animal evidence to make their decision. So it's strange. What was their motivation? Well, it appears that the committee wanted to err on the side of caution, invoking the precautionary principle, and in doing so, believe it was influenced by the activists and by public opinion. And I think that it's fair to say that IARC strayed from its mission of risk assessment, going into the area of risk management. However, if the evidence does not support the existence of a hazard, the basis for making policy recommendations becomes somewhat questionable. In any event, the two things, risk assessment and risk management, need to be clearly distinguished, and they were not. IARC's pronouncement meant one thing to the committee members and something quite different to the general public, which understandably interpreted it as saying that cell phones could cause cancer. As the MD Anderson statistician Donald Berry commented when the announcement was made, everything is a possible carcinogen. Okay. Now, future studies are in the works, and the most important one is called the COSMOS study, and this is a cohort study being conducted in several European countries. It involves the recruitment of 250,000 men and women, and the participants will be followed for a very long period of time. And exposure information will be collected both via questionnaire and objective data from the telecommunications provider, a clear improvement over previous studies. And outcomes will be determined, that is, development of cancer will be determined by using the nationwide tumor cancer registries. However, there's a serious problem here, and that is that in epidemiologic studies, you want a group that is not exposed. And nowadays, it's a virtual impossibility to find a group that's not exposed. So I'm not saying the study is worthless. It's definitely of value, but it's got a real problem. Now, if we're looking for hard evidence for adverse health effects, we need look no further than the effects of than automobile crashes, in which it's determined that that distracted driving was a factor. And these are data from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, and you see the numbers of people killed, 3,328 people in 2012 who were judged to be involved in an accident caused by distracted driving, and 421,000 people injured in such crashes. And this is nearly one-fifth of crashes. So to conclude, rather than focusing attention on the latest study or the study with the most sensational results, attention needs to be focused on the totality of the evidence. It is not only laypersons, advocates, and the media who can fall for distorted versions of the science. Researchers, regulators, and even respected agencies are capable of seizing on selected findings and promoting alarm rather than putting an issue in perspective. We should remember that this whole episode was set in motion not by a strong scientific signal or a compelling hypothesis, but rather by a distraught husband who was eager to find an explanation for his wife's fatal brain cancer. This episode underscores the powerful appeal of an explanation for what causes a poorly understood disease, especially when the explanation invokes a novel technology involving a mysterious form of radiation. Now, we started with the Larry King Live show broadcast in 1993, and in 2008, Larry King hosted another show devoted to cell phones and brain cancer, in which several neurosurgeons expressed their concern about the danger from cell phone radiation. And writing in the New York Times, the science writer John Turney made the following comment on the program. Some prominent brain surgeons made news on Larry King's show this year with their fears of cell phones, thereby establishing once and for all that epidemiology is not brain surgery. It's more complicated. Thank you.
Just about every scientific issue gets more complicated the more you look into it. And that, of course, is certainly the case with the next topic that we're going to approach, and that is genetic modification. And our speaker is Dr. Kevin Folta, who comes to us from the University of Florida, where he's a professor of horticulture. His main interest is actually studying the action of light on plants, and how to use light to make fruits and vegetables more flavorful, how to give them a longer shelf life. That's his main area of interest. But he also is driven to educate the public on scientific issues. And one of the issues that he addresses routinely is genetic modification, which of course is controversial, and he has taken some heat for his talks on genetic modification, and he will explain to you why he has become a lightning rod for some of the anti-GMO activists. So Professor Kevin Folta is going to tell us some very, very interesting stories, not only about genetic modification, but about where it can lead when you talk about it.
Okay, thank you very much for having me in. You hear that okay? That sounds good. All right, good. I'm going to avoid the podium. I just would like to first say thank you very much for coming tonight. Thank you so much to Dr. Schwartz for the invitation to come to this symposium. Thank you very much to Emily Shore, wherever she is, for her outstanding organization of the symposium. And thank you so much to Dr. Lauren Trottier for allowing us this forum to be able to discuss science at the public interface. You're much cooler than that TED guy, whoever that is. So where we are is, let me go forward here, is I'd like to talk today about this issue of genetically modified food, or genetically engineered food, as I would prefer to talk about it. And we'll show you why in a little bit. I was going to just lead right into the talk, but there's been a lot of discussion lately about what's happening with me, some of the questions about my credibility as a speaker in this kind of forum, and so I was asked to give a very detailed disclosure about where funding comes from, where it doesn't come from, what do I do, and so we'll spend the first few minutes on that. My job is a professor, but also a chairman. I work as the chairman in the Department of Horticultural Sciences in the state of Florida for a land-grant institution, meaning that the faculty who work with me take care of the farmers in our state. We don't just take care of students, but farmers and also our citizens. And we have breeding programs that cover strawberries, tomatoes, blueberries, citrus. All of these are faculty in my department. We had the country's first organic and sustainable undergraduate program that teaches our students how to use these techniques and these production methods to raise foods with different environmental considerations and high market value for our farmers. We have plants on the space station. We have people like me who work in the area of genomics in order to use the most modern molecular tools to understand how to make things taste better and maybe how to use light to change the way plants taste. So we really very diverse faculty. My particular research program, still have a laboratory and we still do a lot of cool work. Our main work, again, is in the light area. And currently the only funding my laboratory has is from a $500,000 USDA grant, which is to cover this particular line of work. Past funding in strawberry genomics has allowed us to not only sequence the strawberry genome in 2010, but also understand the genes that are associated with flavors, and that's the main driver. So there's a number of different national and state programs and some funding from strawberry-associated companies that have helped us to do this, and also many different countries where I've sponsored students to come in postdocs to work in my laboratory. I don't mention CONICET, which is another one that should have been on here, which is I've had a number of Argentinian fellows, and also internal grants and things like this. So funding from many diverse sources, zero research funding from Monsanto, never had, I got to say it, never had research funding from them. I've had zero collaborations with them on research. They don't care about what I do. They're worried about corn and soybeans. I'm working with fruit. There's a cool picture of some of the research we do. So the other thing I do is outreach. And this is a big part of what I do. I love that interface with the public. This is something I do many times a week with physicians, with farmers, with scientists. And it's an important part of what I do because just keeping science in the laboratory is not enough. And we need more scientists to do this kind of outreach. And my program is called Talking Biotech. And the main thing I try to do is teach scientists to not be such scientists. I need them to start talking and being teachers. I need them to start talking to a concerned public that's worried about their food and worried about their health. And how do we connect with those people? And that's really been an important emphasis of my program for many years. And over the last 15 years, I've spent a lot of time talking to public audiences about the area of genetic engineering, talking about the good things, the things it doesn't do so well, maybe what's up in the future. All of that participation has brought me a lot of funding from different donors and different contributors. I had money from National Science Foundation to build lights that we used in classrooms to talk to kids about light and how light can influence plant growth. Last year, well, about 1 year ago, I met a employee of the Monsanto company at a conference who said, "Your students, everybody does so well. You guys do such great talks. What's the deal?" I said, "Well, we teach communication. We teach them how to talk to the public." And they said, "Well, this is great. Maybe we have some year-end money and we can sponsor your teaching, your outreach program." And I said, "This would be fantastic because it would allow me, and none of this money goes to me, but it allows me to put out coffee and donuts at the workshop. It allows me to cover maybe an extra night in a hotel, things just so that I can do it." And so they gave us $25,000 to the University of Florida that I could use to write against for my costs associated with outreach. Now, when you're doing very compelling outreach for many years to talk to people about biotechnology and explaining it to them and make it not so scary, you get on the radar screen of many people who really don't want you to do that. And having a connection of dollars to your research, your outreach program, to Monsanto, is exactly what they need to make your life quite miserable. And as part of this, here's some of the things that go on in social media. Monsanto pays for everything. He's just a propagandist. A tiny bit of money compared to what I actually bring into my research program. And Monsanto does not pay for everything I do. They gave a little bit of money to the university. We'll talk about that in a second. So what happened was, is that I was the first of 43 scientists to turn over 3 years of email to U.S. Right to Know, who's funded by the Organic Consumers Association, an organization that found it very disturbing that I was educating people about science. And so what they chose, what they wanted to do, was they said, we want to find out how the industry is influencing your message. And so we need all your emails. And I turned over 4,600 pages of emails. I was the first to comply. I didn't even look at them myself. I really didn't care because I didn't think there's anything terribly weird in there. But however, when you give somebody who doesn't like you 4,600 pages of email, they can find a way to take a little bit here, a little bit here, a little bit here, and build the story they want to tell. Now, that's not the way we work in science, and so I was a little naive about turning them over, but I really did have to be a lot more careful about that. The story they told ended up in the September 5th New York Times, where if you read this, you find Eric Lipton told quite a story. He actually talked about how, you know, about how Monsanto funded all of my travel. And here's a graph that shows the travels funded by Monsanto during my career. Here's one. I had one travel funded by them last year when a group of farmers in Colorado wanted to learn something about this topic, and they didn't want to listen to the company. So the company called me and said, hey, would you mind doing this? I said, sure, I'll do it, but I don't have any money. And they said, well, we'll cover the cost. So that's that. And so all of this really started into this entire this column and other fallout that really doesn't represent me accurately. And what's really disappointing about that is that I'm incredibly transparent, I'm proud of my funding record, and I'm excited to show you where the money comes from that allows me to do what I do. And now you can even go, I've spent about many hours, to put together all of this on a page where you can go through the last 2 years of every seminar, every talk, every thing I've written, who paid, how much they paid, how much I was reimbursed, and what you find is that I lost a lot of money personally. I mean, it costs me money to do things because I don't always get reimbursed. Sometimes I lose receipts. And so I lose money by being in science communication, and maybe I get reimbursed if I'm lucky. Most things are done for free because that's my job as a land-grant scientist. I work for you, or at least those south of the border. I work for them. I work for you, too, though. And so that's my real job. And I'm very transparent about this, and I hope you look here because I really want you to see that. I have nothing to hide. I'm the most transparent guy out there, and I want to set a standard so that the anti-GM people will also adopt that same level of transparency. Don't hold your breath. So here's what happens. Because I participated in this discussion, I'm Monsanto's brain and Monsanto's shill and Monsanto. Here, the world's most discredited professor and getting this money, and he's a lying whore. Here they tell you that I got the money to promote GMOs, which is nothing further from the truth. Then they said here, hilarious, they're putting it on Craigslist in his town. This is nuts. This is hilarious. Well, here they had my deceased mother. They put on there on her birthday, so they knew when they were doing this. They put my address. They put the address of my laboratory. There were veiled death threats. There were quite obvious threats. My boss of my university, when I spoke at Cornell, had to have the FBI terrorist task force involved because of threats against me. Because I teach science. And this is where this gets real serious. They took back that money. My university did. They moved that $25,000 away from science outreach, where we teach kids about citrus greening and teach kids about light, and moved that money to a food pantry, which is great. But that's money out of what I used to use for outreach because of the fallout from this. And what's really sad is that not only have journalists defamed a teacher who just wanted to talk about science and share with the public. Now other scientists won't do what I do. They won't go out and talk to the public. And worse, even today, I was supposed to talk to CBC, and they canceled because they said, we got a call that said that we shouldn't hear from you. So not only are scientists not participating in this discussion, and students are being scared away from it, the outlets where we would discuss it are not accepting a scientific message. This is a crisis situation, folks. And this is being brought about by fear and other issues which are being catalyzed by this debate around genetic engineering. So that long introduction now will lead to what I would like to present to you today. That's very nice. But wait, there's more. Never missing a pile to jump onto. The food babe Vani Hari on InfoWars, where you can buy oxygen in a bottle, and then she can sell you an antioxidant on her website. She also has requested all my emails, and so she will be receiving those as well. And I just wanted to mention that there's a book coming out called The Fear Babe, where I've written the foreword, and this will be coming out October 29th. So, and this is really the point, is that now we have people who are going after a teacher because I'm costing them money, and I'm just teaching the science. And now I want to walk you through that today, because no matter what you feel about transgenic crops or this idea of genetic engineering, whether you're for it, whether you're against it, whether you're on the fence, I really want you to challenge your thinking on this. And I want to take you to a different place in the way you think about it, because I think about this very differently than most people, because I've been studying it since I was a 10-year-old kid who took a book out of the Downers Grove Public Library on recombinant DNA technology. Nerd. And I've been studying this forever, and I get it, and I want to share this with you so you do too. And please, let this be our introduction. Don't hesitate to email me, contact me, phone call me. I know your emails will be part of a FOIAble record. But the point is, I want this to be an introduction. I want to be available to you, and I want you to understand this, whatever it takes. Okay, so here we go. I guess the first question I'd like to ask is by applause, how many people think that genetic engineering as a technology has many more benefits than risks and is generally a good thing? Okay. And how many people think that this is, by applause, is a generally more risky than beneficial and probably pretty negative? Come on, a few of you out there, right? Yeah, that's good. You know, don't be shy. It's kind of sad. I can go home now. How many people, this is always the biggest group usually. This is a scientific audience maybe, so maybe a little different, but how many people are just not sure? Okay. And that's good, because you're the folks I would like to reach the most, and you're the ones I'm shooting for here. The folks who really like this technology, I'd like you to think about ways that I communicate this and think about ways you could incorporate this into the way that you talk to people about it. So, I wanted to ask you this first. Just yell out for me real quick. What we talk about food and food sustainability, food and food systems. What are your concerns? Anybody? Antibiotics. What else? So herbicides. So food safety issues is where we're going there. Food safety. What else? Price. So food safety and price. And what else? I'm sorry? Nutrition. Okay, that's a good one. Sustainability. So we're talking about environment. We're talking about safety. We're talking about quality. And any audience that I ask in the developed world, in the industrialized world, tends to tell me this. I'm psychic, too. So you guys really did fit exactly what this audience says. Now, let me tell you what's important to me. Or better yet, let me tell you what's important to the Alliance for Science Fellows, who come from all over the world from 10 different developing countries. When I ask them, they say, we're worried about the developing world. We're worried about people who are starving. We're worried about food safety and farmers. We're worried about the environment. And we're not so worried about the people on the wealthy side of the planet. When you ask me what's important and how I prioritize this, it's very similar. To me, you know, I worry about those folks who have nothing. It's been a really emotional time lately, so excuse me. For me, why do I put my feet on the floor every morning and go do this? And why do I have, you know, this stuff about on the internet about who I am and what I'm about? This is where I come from, and this is why I want you to understand who I am and where I'm coming from, because why I want to remodel the way you think about this question. I'm thinking about serving others. I'm not so worried about taking care of myself, and I'm not so worried about how we can have more sustainable farming here in the States, in our environment. In the United States, not here in the States. So we have a good situation. Our food supply is the most plentiful it's ever been. Fewer people have to be employed to make this food supply. The average age of the American, North American farmer is 58, and very few people coming up behind them. But it's the fact that a few people are willing to do this work that 99% of us don't have to do it. And that we can pursue things like leisure time, that we can study other things, we can have other jobs. And this is what's really set up the problem we have, is that we have this new distrust of food. Now let me hit you with a couple concepts and then we'll talk about them in detail. Right now we know that humans have always participated in plant and animal genetic changes. We know that this technology is a precise extension of breeding. We know, and this is a great quotation, that the techniques we use pose no more risk than traditional breeding. And that reminds us that even when we're rubbing plant parts together to create a new kind of plant, a new variety, there's some risk there. In 18 years since we've been doing this, there has not been one case of illness associated with a transgenic plant or a GM plant or plant product. And we don't make any transgenic animals for consumption yet, and there's really just 10 traits. Three traits in 10 commercial crops in general. Now the problem is that when you have new technology and you have something like the internet, you now create a situation where people can do their own research, and really the only experts are the ones online, and experts like me don't really matter anymore. We've been marginalized by too much information that isn't always of good quality. And so how are we going to fix that? And what we have to do is we'll zip through this today in about the next half hour. Lots of material to cover. We'll talk about how we do this genetic improvement, about where our crops come from, how our current traits work, because if you understand the current technology, it's not so spooky, and what are the things we didn't do and how we go forward. And I really just want you to rethink this entire question. I think that you'll be surprised where we come from. So humans have been genetically improving crops for a long time, and what we get are better yields and maybe better products. We get improved nutrition, maybe grow in other places where they previously didn't grow. And so plant genetic improvement has been something that has gone with the human explosion of population and really allowed us to have civilization. But if you ask a general audience what plant genetic improvement is, they have a very different idea. It's something very sinister, something maybe we shouldn't be doing. But what exactly are we doing when we're genetically improving a plant? Well, let's talk about genetically improving animals. What's natural? And here's broilers from 1957, and this is the number of days after they've been grown. And you can see how breeding and human intervention in the genetic improvement of chickens, in this case, produced a much better product with much better commercial variety, much better commercial quality. And that's just in something like broilers. If we look at plant materials, or our crops, we can look at this in a slightly different way. None of this, or very little of it, came from North America. And this map is a really interesting one because it shows the centers of origins of all of our different crops, or many of our different crops. And what you find is that citrus came from Southeast Asia, that onions are over here by Pakistan, alfalfa from the Middle East, almonds from the Middle East, apples from Kazakhstan, sugar beets, lettuce. Everything that we eat was from somewhere else, and now is a foreigner on our soil. And this is important to remember because this was human-mediated. And what I'd like to get you comfortable with is the idea that genetic changes and changes in plants are sometimes mediated by humans, actually more often than not. Nature didn't give us anything very good. That what we have and the incredible bounty of the most healthy and wonderful food supply in human history is because humans intervened. Some evidence for this is in this slide, and I do a whole talk on crop domestication that maybe we'll talk about some other year, but the idea is that the ancestral forms of our crops, this is corn in its great-great-great-great-grandparent, and modern-day corn. And this to this took 16,000 years, and many generations of someone identifying the one plant that didn't die, and then keeping those seeds for the next year, planting those seeds, keeping the one that had a little higher yield. And through time, that created this much better version of this antecedent. But we see all the tremendous improvements of our fruits and vegetables happening in all of our different areas, whether it's seeds that have been removed from bananas by adding chromosomes or tomatoes and all the varieties of tomatoes that come from these primitive forms that are almost horticulturally useless. Humans have intervened in changing plants. And we've done it in some really wild ways. The next thing I'll show you is a table that is really complicated, but I'll explain to you what this is about. And if you Google Frankenfood paradox, you'll find this. What it tells us is that we make plants in different ways. We do genetic improvement in different ways. We can make hybrids, where we're just crossing plants. We can make polyploids, where we artificially double or naturally double chromosome numbers. We can do what's called mutation breeding, where we add either chemicals to seeds or use radiation to damage DNA and create genetic variation. We can cross species barriers, crossing plants that would never cross in nature. It may be cases where we have to go out and pull out the embryo out of the seed and put it in culture in order to get it to grow. So weird, but we do that. All of that, we have no idea what genes were changing. We have no idea what genes were moving. We have no idea how many genes we're affecting. No clue. Nobody tests. Nobody cares. Nobody wants to label it. Certainly nobody's too worried about it. That's what we've done forever, moving tens of thousands of genes at a time. Now let's talk about the technology that we use in genetic engineering. Here, we're moving one gene, maybe a couple others. We know exactly what it does. We understand it. We can trace it. We understand exactly how it works. And yet, this is the technology that people are afraid of. The thing that we understand, the surgical version, is the thing that freaks people out. Whereas all of this wild west of plant genetic improvement, moving whole chromosomes and tons of genes at one time, nobody really cares. And to someone who's a kind of an aspiring plant breeder and someone who knows genomes, it just doesn't compute. Humans can have the opportunity now to induce these precise changes that we understand that have much more safety. And we can do that. This is what you see online when you're asked about how this process is done. And there's nothing further from the truth. For one, we don't use a syringe or anything like that. The whole process is based upon this bacterium called Agrobacterium tumefaciens, which is nature's genetic engineer. It's able to move a piece of its DNA into a host's plant cell and kind of sets up shop inside that plant cell. It's a natural infection is what this thing does. It moves a piece of DNA. And Agrobacterium does this, and the process is very complicated. But what the idea basically is that you can use the bacterium to move the gene of your interest into that plant cell. It's done by a little bacterium that does this process. And then you take that one cell, and you can use culture to grow it into a whole plant. Now, I just told you in 2 minutes what would normally take an entire lecture. But the idea is that this is a very well-established process of moving using a bacterium to install the gene into a single cell that we can now grow into an entire plant. So these are the current crops that are available. And I think people are surprised to see things like wheat not on here. It was even on Joe's slide last night that there's wheat. So there's like corn, soy, alfalfa, cotton, potato. These are newcomers that aren't quite available yet. But all of these, at least these four, are in the human food supply. These are limited acreage. So these are the crops that are available now. And the three traits that are really available we'll walk through very quickly: virus resistance, insect resistance, and herbicide resistance. Because I want you to understand how these work, because when you understand how they work, they're not nearly as scary. So first we'll talk about virus resistance. And virus resistance works because of a process called RNA interference. And RNA interference is a pretty cool process. And it's a natural process in a cell that when a cell gets a virus, certain kinds of virus, it'll turn on a process that will degrade the genetic material of that virus. So if you're able to put in a gene that you want to silence, like let's say a viral gene, if you put in some sequences, you can then target that gene to turn it off or turn off that virus. And I know that wasn't very clear. But what the general idea is that you can introduce a construct into, you can introduce to the plant, engineer in, a copy of the virus in a way that it essentially cancels out the virus that's infecting the plant. And when you do that, it allows the plant to grow. The nice part about it is that these are sequences that are naturally there upon viral infection. And that it really cuts the needs for insecticides to control the insects that vector virus around the plants. The bad news is that there is a problem with pollen containment. If you go to Hawaii, there are growers who would like to grow non-GM papayas who sometimes have trouble doing that because of pollen drift. And that's a consideration we always need to keep in mind. Oops, I lost a few slides there, but we'll go ahead and talk about Roundup Ready. So Roundup Ready is the other area that people are very interested in. And Roundup Ready really is a way of a farmer to plant something like soybeans And as the plants start to grow, you can use an herbicide over the top to kill all the weeds, but leave the soybeans still growing. So the herbicide kills everything except for the plants that have been engineered to resist it. And I'll tell you about how that works, because it sounds kind of scary, but it's actually pretty simple. Now, if we look at a biochemical pathway, and think about this as some product being converted to some product, being converted to some product, that ultimately ends up as amino acids, which are the building blocks of proteins. There's an enzyme in plants called EPSPS that catalyzes that step. It takes B, turns it into C. But when you use glyphosate, this compound that's in Roundup, glyphosate binds to the EPSPS enzyme, and it blocks its function. And when you block that function, the plant can't make amino acids, and it dies. Now, bacteria have a very similar biochemical pathway that uses a slightly different form of that enzyme. And when you take that enzyme and you put glyphosate on it, it doesn't care. It doesn't bind it. So now you see how simple this could be. What if you could take this one and put it in the plant? Then that plant, in theory, could grow in the presence of the herbicide. And that's exactly how this process works, that the plant enzyme is essentially, well, we add the bacterial enzyme into that system, and now that plant lives just fine. It doesn't bind glyphosate, and the plant now can survive. Nothing terribly magical. It's almost like changing your light bulb, throwing it away, and putting in one of those LED ones. It's a more efficient way of doing exactly the same thing. And now allows these plants, gives the farmers a very powerful tool to be able to use less time and less labor in being able to grow their crops. The advantage of this is that farmers can now apply a very low toxicity herbicide that is cheap and works well. The disadvantage is that you start to grow weeds that become resistant to this technology, and that's what's happened over the last 15 years. That when you're using such stringent selection, you're killing all the weeds, the ones that can survive now propagate. And things like Palmer amaranth make 500,000 seeds and they propagate like wildfire. And one of the downsides of this technology that we're seeing right now is the presence of glyphosate-resistant weeds. And the heat map here shows that the hotter colors represent greater numbers of these weeds. And this is one of the big challenges and certainly a downside of this technology. So I would like to use the rest of the time today to talk about success stories we can't use, because this is really where I want to focus. This is what I want you to think about when we talked about the things that we share as our common values, to take care of people, to take care of the planet, to take care of the farmers, to have food that's safe. That's stuff that we all want. We can do that. Those technologies exist, but we can't use them because of a complex regulatory system and a public that is afraid of this technology. So I need you to dream with me and understand how we can use this to fix the things that we care about. Because when we can do that, we can move this technology forward. So let's talk about some of the things we can do. The papaya ring spot virus is already done. This kind of got a little bit out of place here. But this was where we used this RNA interference. These have the transgene. Oh, no, these do. These don't. And you can see the difference in the survival of the plants. The next slide shows this really well. Here are plants that are genetically engineered, surrounded by those that aren't. And you can see how the virus just destroys the vigor of that crop. Now, we can apply that same technology to some other plant species as well. The other place that we can do this is in biofortification, and golden rice is the first example. Golden rice is an example where you can use the genes from something like carrot to be able to make rice, which is white, produce beta-carotene, the golden component of carrots. And what this allows you to do is now be able to produce rice that could alleviate, at least in part, some of the vitamin A deficiency, which kills between 250 and 500,000 people a year, something that definitely would be an interest in the developing world. And the same technology has been applied to cassava, which is a vigorous root vegetable that is a staple in Africa. A lot of this goes to waste because of cassava virus. And in this case, cassava brown streak virus decimates African farms. And we can fix this with the same technology used on that papaya. This is being opposed by Greenpeace. This can be done and should be done and should be deployed. Similarly, in Africa, the use of vitamin A-enriched bananas, beta-carotene-enriched bananas, that now people who have bananas as 70% of their calories can survive and have enhanced vision because of the presence of this trace nutrient in their food. They need to get less than a tiny fraction of a grain of sand a day of this stuff. And they don't get it, but here they can get it. And again, people standing in the way of deployment of this technology. And this isn't Monsanto, folks. This is the governments of Uganda, of Kenya, of Nigeria, the Gates Foundation. Folks here who are trying to do the right thing, yet people standing in the way. We need to de-Monsantoize this conversation and talk about the way we can solve the problems we want to see solved. And this is my podcast here, Talking Biotech. If you want to listen more of this, they do interviews with these folks who are very fascinating people. They also have a problem with bacterial wilt, that bananas die because of bacteria that decimate the banana crop. And part of the problem is that you don't have good antimicrobial controls in places like Africa where you can spray them and control the bacteria. Yet there are a number of genes that can be installed into this plant, in the banana, that make them resistant. And some nice examples here, that this is the genetically engineered ones. This is the one that's not genetically engineered. And you can see the difference. And if you're a farmer in Africa growing bananas for your family or other families, and you have to make this crop work, this would be extremely valuable. And it's not just a one-gene solution. There's different genes that do this very well. So we wouldn't have the same kind of threats of resistance like you would see in glyphosate. And resistance to weeds. This could be a very durable tool, and they're pushing this as hard as they can towards deployment, yet people are standing in the way, saying that genetic engineering is dangerous and that this is going to harm people. In Africa, they tell the men it's going to make you impotent, tell the women it's going to make you infertile. They're scaring them away from this technology. In the industrialized world, children walk around in school with EpiPens because of allergies to peanuts. Here's an example where science has been able to suppress the major allergens in peanuts, turn them off. It's been done. Why don't we see it? Because it costs money to commercialize, and no industry is going to do it because of the high cost and because of no public acceptance. This is something that could save lives. It's not being used. We have chickens that have been invented back in 2011 that don't get bird flu. And this year in the American Midwest, they bulldozed 45 million birds in the landfills because of this virus. We can stop that virus just by having these birds that are genetically engineered with a cool trick that doesn't allow them to transmit it. They get sick and die, but it's not contagious. Super cool. We could do this, but we don't do it, again, because of the lack of acceptance. We have salmon that can grow to market weight in half the time. And if you think about the early effects of high-protein diets and good protein diets for children, this could make fish proteins more accessible to the young people in our countries and worldwide. Again, none of these are the big ag companies. These are small startups. This fish was made in 1989 and still has not been released for human consumption, although all the tests have been done for years. It's a political decision. It's a political decision. It's not a decision made on science. We know pigs that can be engineered to have lower phosphorus output, which is tremendous for our environment. We have potatoes that will grow and produce less of this chemical called acrylamide, which is a carcinogen and a neurotoxin that is produced by potatoes when you fry them. These new potatoes that are now approved don't produce those levels of acrylamide. They also don't brown, they don't bruise, which means that a farmer has the same amount of land can get a much higher yield of marketable potatoes because they won't have to take out the bruised ones, which Americans won't buy. So again, it's something that is helpful for the environment and helpful for the consumer. Non-browning apples, again, another technology that makes it more likely that the food that we pick from that tree gets into a human because it's not going to turn brown when you cut it. It can be used in more applications and more recipes. In Florida, we have this thing called BS2 tomato, which is a pepper gene put into tomatoes. They're cousins on the evolutionary tree. And what it allows us to do is you can see the difference between the genetically engineered ones and the non-engineered ones, which have a very bad bacterial disease. And you can see it better here. These are not genetically engineered. These are genetically engineered. And the control for this disease is currently copper. And so conventional and organic farmers use between 6 and 10 pounds of copper as a pesticide on these crops. And they have to do it usually weekly. So huge amounts of a heavy metal going into our environment, and packing houses for tomatoes have so much copper in them that it has to be treated as toxic waste. This gene from a neighbor, a pepper gene in tomato, would allow us to grow these plants more sustainably without those inputs. It saves money for farmers. It's easier on the environment. Why aren't we doing it? Because of fear. We have grapes that can grow in Florida. We have a BT brinjal, which I didn't talk about BT, but this is an anti-insect protein, which allows these to be grown in Bangladesh, and they're doing very well there at this point. Normally, it's children who are spraying pesticides with no protective equipment in Bangladesh, and this allows them to not have to have that exposure. Yet there are people who are standing in the way of this as well. We can engineer healthier oils into things like canola or cotton that allow us to not have to depend on fish for high nutritional value oils. In my state, all of our trees are citrus trees are dying. Most of you may not know about this, but in Florida, we have something like 90 to 100% of our groves are infected with a disease called huangbongling, or HLB, or citrus greening disease. This is what it looks like. The trees are just dying, and they're dropping all their fruit. We have genetic engineering solutions. But how do you go from a genetic engineering solution that takes 10, 13 years to approve and then make 60 million trees? Trees, not little plants. And then get them up to production. Our industry is in a state of peril, and we needed this back in 2005. Yet we're waiting for the solution still because the industry is afraid of a backlash from the consumers. In my lab, we made strawberries that don't require fungicide. And so fungicides are very prevalent on strawberries. These are treated with fungus. These are treated with fungus. These have a gene turned on all the time that helps them resist. It's a plant gene that helps them resist the fungal infection. And so you don't have to use fungicides. This seems brilliant. But our industry doesn't want it because they're afraid of boycotts. So who's blocking the solutions? Where does the fear come from? And what it comes from is a very highly paid level of people who are making a lot of money by getting in the way of science, who are requesting my emails because I come here to tell you about tomatoes and oranges that can help benefit from this technology. The big problem, and a lot of this is anti-corporate, and one great quotation by Hank Campbell is, these people hate corporations more than they love people, and I think there's a lot of truth to that. So we'll talk a little bit about myths, and then we got to wrap it up. Maybe I even have to skip the myths, but we'll talk briefly. This is one of the most famous images, are three rats that they say link genetically modified food to tumors. This paper originally came out in 2012. There's three rats. One that gets GMO, which no scientist would ever put the word GMO. It's not a scientific term, so I'm curious there. GMO plus Roundup and Roundup alone. And then these rats are miserably tortured animals that are exceeding any level of animal laboratory ethics. If this was in my lab, I'd be shut down. You don't let this happen to animals. What's missing? Control. What about the rat that didn't get GMOs or Roundup? Well, if you look on table two, he got tumors too. So this is a very compelling figure that has been used in the anti-GMO movement. And it's been used to scare people into resisting the cassava for the people in Africa, the oranges for Florida, to ask for my emails because of this. And you see the problem we have here, folks, is that we're getting bad information, and it's stoking fear and making a very compelling narrative. I had some other things I wanted to zip through here, but I think I'm going to skip that so I can get to the end. We know that right now we have the safest food supply in human history, yet we're being misled into being suspicious of it. And it's being fomented even more for a profit, and this bothers me a lot. Companies like Chipotle say, a farewell to GMOs. Just because if you can guarantee that a huge part of the population is afraid of this, whether it has any merit or not, but then say, hey, guess what? We don't have that over here. Now you're making a brilliant business decision on horrible science. And the funny part is, their soda still has high fructose corn syrup from GE crops, and all of their cheese is made with microbial rennets, which are generated in genetically modified, probably fungus, made with a camel gene. So they still are using GMOs. They just don't tell you that. So I'm going to wrap it up here. We got a couple minutes. The last thing I'll talk to you about, how do you talk to people about this? And when I talk to different audiences, I like to give them a take-home assignment. The mistake we've made as scientists, and I did it for 12 years, was talk to a public audience do this wrong. And it's because activists key off of emotions. You have people who aren't experts who are using the messages of fear to influence the majority of people on the center of that curve. Scientists are coming at this not by saying, let me tell you how this is right or wrong or why it relates to what you care about. We're coming at it and saying, guess what? Well, this paper, the statistics show this with a 95% confidence, and people turn off and they don't care. Scientists have been screwing this up. The companies have screwed this up. How do we fix it? We have to be, as scientists, speaking to the folks in the center of the curve, not wasting our time down here. And the other things we have to do are avoid some simple mistakes. Get rid of this feed the world rhetoric. Our farmers feel very passionate about feeding the world. They say they feed the world. But it's a throwaway concept. It's a throwaway line. It's cliche. We don't feed a world. We're trying to feed his world. We're trying to feed that family's world. We're trying to feed that town in Africa. These are specific examples that I can point to ad nauseum, and I can introduce you to people in those places who can tell you how this technology could change their lives. We need to be specifically speaking to these specific instances. Always discuss the strengths and limitations. If you're going to talk about Roundup resistance saving money for farmers, you have to talk about how the weed resistance is coming. It's how you have credibility as a speaker. We never claim it as a single solution. Scientists don't say biotechnology is going to solve everything. What we say is that it's a part of a plan, that we will use genetic engineering in oranges along with better nutrition, insect control, improved genetics, other tricks to solve that problem of citrus greening. And the other problem is that it's very attractive for people who are in the area of biotechnology to bash ideas like organic or sustainable production, where I don't go there. There are two different ways of solving a problem, and actually they work really well together. We're all looking for sustainable farming here, and that we have to keep that in mind. This is just a tool that we can use to fix the things we care about. It's really important that we remember that. So farmers are taking action. They're getting very involved in social media, and if you care about this topic, I hope you do too. It's right now that's dominated with bad information, and we need more credible voices in that space. Excellent opportunities online for you to integrate. And I left conclusions open because it depended on time, and so I got maybe a minute, so I'll conclude with a couple things. What I really hope to impress upon you today is that this is not Monsanto's technology. This is your technology. It's my technology. Don't let them have it. Why don't we think about the things that we can do with a very safe way of moving a gene from one place to another in a very predictable and very precise way? We need to lower regulations. We need to empower our academic institutions. We need to have more funding for research in the public sector. Let me play in this space. I would love to compete with Monsanto. I'd probably win. The trick is to give us more options. Right now, it's only a place that they can play because they're the only ones with the money and the lawyers and the know-how to get through it. We need to have a wider dialogue and a better dialogue, especially with those that oppose the technology, to make sure that we're implementing it safely and correctly. And that's best done by those of us in the public sector, the public sector scientists that aren't really Monsanto prostitutes. You know, I want to do this, and we all need to be on the same page for that to happen. So if you listen to the podcast, I think it's really good. It's driven by excellent guests. I just ask a question now and then, and I hope you listen to it. It's really good. And the last thing I'll conclude with is if you don't know the name Norman Borlaug, I want you to go home and Google him tonight. And sorry. It's been a really bad month. You know, I put my feet on the floor in the morning for the same reason he did. How do we use technology to solve problems we care about? How do we solve problems for people? How do we fix this? And this is why we need to have a better conversation around this topic. I want to wrap up with one quick thing. How many people who were on the fence before we came in feel a little bit better about this technology? Okay. Well, then my job is done then, and I will look forward to your questions. Thank you very much.
Surely there can't be any questions. One thing that Kevin told me when we were chatting earlier that maybe didn't come across as clearly is the orange problem in Florida, and was saying that this may be the last year that we have oranges from Florida. And I mean, that's just a mind-boggling statement. And it's a problem that has heard a possible solution. Okay, questions, if you can please go to the mic. The lady in the back was first.
Thank you for the wonderful 2 days. My question to Kevin, then in a sentence for those of us that are sitting on the fence, is, as you started out in your lecture saying, is that people were crossing plants and transferring all kinds of millions of genes, and they didn't care, and it came out okay. And now GMO is just a more select process of doing that, that continuum. Is that sort of the main point that I could take away?
I think that is a point you can take home, is that we've been doing genetic modification for a long time. Over the years, many people perished because they ate a plant product that was poisonous, and they didn't pass on their genes to do the next round of selection of those genetics. So much of the food we have today has been sterilized by time, that we've been able to clean up that clean up those plant lines to give us very safe food that we have today.
Appreciate it, and I wish you all the best. My second point, Dr. Joe, who's done many wonderful things and many wonderful programs, and also to the other speakers, I have another 363 days to go by before this happens again. I can listen to you on Sundays, but one of the things I find terribly hard is separating what I should listen to, what I should read, and it almost all sounds believable out there. Can somebody tell me, what do I listen to, what do I read, because I have a hard time filtering stuff. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I think you just mentioned who you should listen to. Boom. Okay, to the front.
Okay. I have a son who's allergic to fish, and one of the things that's come up with genetic modification is someone talked about splicing fish genes into corn or something. Is my son going to suddenly eat a piece of corn and get allergic reaction?
Well, let's address it on two levels. First, there never was a fish gene introduced into any plant that's ever found commercialization. So you're safe.
Okay, that's important.
But secondly, we understand what the proteins are that cause the allergies. And it's actually a very small number of proteins that are present in the plant and animal world that trigger the allergic responses. And we know what those are. And so when a new plant is created using genetic engineering, it would be very easy, but also be very incumbent upon the creator to identify if that would change those genes. So I think you're generally very safe.
Okay. I have another question that's less important to me. I want to know why Florida tomatoes taste so bad.
Well, I'll answer that on two levels. First, the issue is a production question. We're generating massive amounts of tomatoes for food service, which have to do very well for the farmer. So they're picked green, hard as rocks, and they're using ethylene gas, which is a natural plant hormone, to induce the ripening process. The good news is that that's changing. And if you Google Garden Gem or Garden Treasure, these are two tomatoes that were generated by Dr. Harry Klee in the Plant Innovation Center in Florida to start to address putting the flavors back into. And this is being done with traditional breeding. So good times ahead for your tomatoes.
Okay, because you did mention flavors at the beginning, and I was glad
to
hear that.
No, it's our new focus. Okay. Plant breeding has taken out the flavors because we've been looking for production traits. But now we have an opportunity in the age of genomics to breed those flavor and sensory characteristics back in. So very good question.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, we will take the questions from the people who are already at the mics now. Okay. So we'll go to the back.
Okay. I'm very interested in your talk about the cell phones and radio frequency radiation and potential for brain tumors. I am an Ottawa-based scientist and have looked into this on a broad basis, and right from in vitro DNA damage to sperm, and the more recent epidemiological studies, we're seeing very consistent evidence of biochemical changes and also strengthening evidence of in the epidemiology that we are seeing brain tumors increasing. It was reported just yesterday in Calgary that brain tumors in Calgary spiked by 30% between 2012 and 2013. And when I appreciate, because I work in the field, epidemiology can be very, very complicated. But nevertheless, if when Hardell's methods were applied to the interphone studies, his results were replicated. There was a study in France which also produced similar increases in brain tumor incidence. There's a lot of information that has come out since IARC did its work, and just this June in California, the leader of that team said that today it would be upgraded to a probable carcinogen. We're seeing breast tumors.
We heard the question. Please let's hear the answer.
Who have been carrying phones. So there is a lot of evidence. And so I'm wondering how you scope what you present when you come to a presentation like this, when there is this huge amount of evidence that is out there saying that there's reason to be cautious with our devices, when there are lots of ways that we can be more cautious.
Well, I'm glad you asked the question, because I had 35 or 40 minutes to discuss the evidence, okay? And you're saying that there's other evidence of that there is a hazard there, okay? I relied on by far the largest, most transparent study, okay? You can find all sorts of results where there are blips. The fact is that even Hardell's results are not consistent over time. If you look at his 2006 papers and his 2011 papers, the details are not the same. And he combines different data sets, he does different analyses, he does many, many analyses, and he, lo and behold, he gets some interesting appearing findings. Okay, as for the rates in Calgary, Calgary is a pretty small place, and when you look at cancer rates in different size cities, provinces, you're going to get lots of fluctuations. Brain cancers are very, very rare. When you look at whole countries, that's why I showed you data for the United States. I didn't have time to show you data for the Nordic countries, Scandinavian countries, and so forth. You see over time nothing going on. You're going to see fluctuations, just as you're going to see positive results in these in vitro studies. And as I tried to point out, you're going to see results in epidemiologic studies.
Thank you. Take a question from up here. Thanks.
Yeah. This is for Kevin. You know, I kind of took a lot of science courses and all that stuff. I wasn't convinced. I was one of those people on the fence. And you mentioned one thing that's so important to me, because I worked in nuclear power industry. And nuclear power and GMO have one thing in common, amongst others probably, nobody died, right? You said that today. In nuclear power, we have the same problem. I designed nuclear power plants 50 years ago. And I'm talking about nuclear power plants. I'm not talking about Chernobyl or Fukushima in Japan. These aren't nuclear power plants where people die in the power plant. So nobody died in a nuclear power plant, but we don't have them in North America to speak of. You can put them on all. And GMOs, are, like you say, they're not eating a lot of countries. Isn't that so important to tell people? Nobody's died.
Well, I think the safety record is pretty incredible when you consider how many, most of the GM crops that are made, most of the soy and corn, goes to animal feed. And so you look at the trillions of animals that have, trillions of meals that have been consumed in hundreds of billions of animals, and their metrics remain very static. You don't see major epidemiological changes in our farm animals. In humans who've been consuming these, you don't see epidemiological trends which are linked to those kinds of foods. So it is very important to emphasize the safety record.
Thank you.
Very good.
To the back, please.
Hi, this question is also go to Kevin. Thank you. I just say thank you in advance for clarifying the science behind GMOs. I was a bit unclear on it before. I'm just going to take a little break from the science and ask about, you know, the GMO patenting industry. You know, how Monsanto patents certain seeds and those seeds aren't really available to certain farmers. What's your view on that?
No, it's actually, let me just touch on the idea of plant patents. So even the traditionally bred plants, so when we generate that new citrus tree that revolutionizes the industry because it resists disease, that will be a patented tree. And farmers that wish to grow it will pay a dollar or two per tree to be able to grow it. And the reason is because innovation is expensive. And for us to generate that one tree that may not be genetically modified, that one tree, even its traditional bred, will probably cost $10 million to create that tree. When you look at all the thousands of acres of progeny that need to be screened, of trees that need to be screened, the land use charges, the fertilizers, the labor, the management. So patents are a way of guaranteeing innovation, that if a little bit of money comes back to the person who did that invention, it helps to ensure that further varieties will be produced. And it has been a sore spot in this discussion, and it's unfortunate because the patent process really does ensure more innovation. And if we're going to have better varieties, we need to be able to make sure the inventor gets a little something.
Sorry, just a little part two. Given the lack of diversity in GMO development, doesn't that give lead to maybe a monopoly of the market or a monopoly of the seeds? Let's say you're talking about Slanga cassava, or I forget the name of the plant exactly, in Africa.
Sure.
But if Monsanto has that patent over that plant and that market is completely saturated in those seeds, doesn't that make a sort of monopoly that's hard for the African market to compete with in itself?
Well, yes, and that's a good point. We don't necessarily want there to be all the seeds and licensing in one set of hands. And the nice way to do that would be to make a more fair playing field where deregulation was something that more people could participate in. For something like cassava, those aren't being done by Monsantos and the Dows of the world. In a lot of cases, these are being done by the African, Kenyan, Nigerian governments who have started their own programs because they said to the West, we're not waiting for you anymore. We got people to feed. And thank goodness they do it. So how that'll be patented and protected, I don't know. But most of these things will be done, I'm guessing, with freely distributed seeds.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I came into the lecture with a certain question in my mind about modified plants, and I didn't quite find the answer in your very interesting talk. My question is, these plants that are modified, they're modified for health reasons, and I'm 100% behind it, but can they reproduce themselves, or do the farmers have to go again and buy original seeds? That's what I haven't understood.
Sure. Well, let me give you some good answers on that. So this idea of selling seed to farmers every year comes up all the time because people think that's kind of patently unfair, that farmers shouldn't have to do that. Farmers have been buying new corn seeds every year since 1923 when the company, I don't remember the name now, maybe it's Asgrow, introduced the first line of hybrid corn, that you took two parents that were very different, that when you combined them gave you a very good hybrid. And then when you let that hybrid self-pollinate and then use those seeds, the seeds were very unpredictable the next year. So the seed industries in the United States and the companies that ran them became very big very quickly because of the ability to sell the farmer an improved product every year. And so this is the same tradition that's been maintained. I think a big part of it from the farmer perspective is that they want to farm for making food and making a product, not for making seeds to grow the next year. Which requires different production practices. It doesn't work well in wet climates, and you have to have good storage facilities and handling facilities. Plus, it's nice that when they don't germinate the next year, you got a company that you can hold accountable. So most farmers are comfortable with these ideas and factor in the added costs into their operation.
Okay, so from that I take that they don't reproduce themselves.
Oh, they do reproduce themselves, yes. I'm sorry, I missed that part of it. So you may be referring to this. It's a very commonly held myth.
I'm not thinking of agribusiness only.
Sure.
I'm thinking of little the plots that we we use, we have urban farms.
Yes.
For instance.
No, you can do whatever you like there. And the urban farms, I mean, these seeds do reproduce themselves just fine. There was a lot of myth around something called Terminator seeds years ago. It was a technology that was thought up by a guy named Melvin Oliver at the USDA back in the late 90s in a way to protect patents and genetics. It was never developed. And it was an interesting idea. In a lot of ways, it would help us with containment of genetically modified seeds, but it was never developed.
Thank you.
So, thank you.
My question is for Dr. Kebat. Knowing that the effects of RF radiation is fairly well studied, and knowing that the effects are mainly in thermal effects, how do you suggest we address the discrepancy when communicating with people about those dangers between what the dangers actually are, thermal effects, and what is the public perception of those dangers, which is usually in the area of cancers and other rare and unusual effects?
How should it be explained to the public? Well, I think one place to start is looking, explaining the electromagnetic spectrum, explaining the difference between ionizing radiation and showing that there's this enormous gradient, and that explaining how heating microwaves only induce heating at a certain power level, and cell phones and Wi-Fi are at very, very low power levels settings compared to the levels at which you're not climbing inside a microwave oven, which would not be recommended. So it's a question of putting things, it's a question of really trying to get some basic facts across. And, you know, you have to, walking in a city, you have to watch out for falling cinder blocks off of buildings or cornices or whatever, but you don't have to worry about leaves falling on your head. There's just a vast difference that needs to be, and you know, there's no certainty, but one has to appreciate the how big how weak these fields are.
Thank you.
Hi. My question's for Dr. Folta in terms of current farming methods. And I remember it was quite a while ago, so I might not remember correctly, but I remember watching a TED Talk in which the person who was speaking went on about how there used to be many different breeds of, I think it was apples he was talking about, and how these days, because of farming methods and, you know, choosing whatever fruits or whatever it may be are the most to people's taste or the best at that time has actually caused a long-term detriment, in that natural selection does end up playing a process in what fruits and things are still available. And something that this speaker was getting towards was, you know, in 50 years we might not have bananas. So would you say that that those issues discussed are due to genetic engineering and current farming methods, or do you see that genetic engineering can be more of a solution to this problem?
A very good question. And actually, a very good question, and I'll answer this in two ways. First, I do see genetic engineering as being a solution to this in many ways. The best example is banana. And so your reference is into narrowing genetics, that as we've gone through as plant breeders, and we've said this one grows really well, so let's keep growing it every year after year after year. Grapes or grape varieties have been around for thousands of years, hundreds of years, and we don't change them. The genetics are very static. Potatoes, bananas, grapes are great examples. Genetic engineering gives you the opportunity to add the one new trait, and the reason that we've kept them is because to breed a new grape is very difficult. takes a long time, and very, very difficult to get a grape that has all of the qualities of disease resistance and production and still tastes well and performs well in wine, for instance. So if you needed to, if you had a disease like in, let's just use bananas, like bacterial wilt, Xanthomonas disease, to be able to add that one gene that preserves all the favorable genetics but now gives that one extra boost to put it over the top, that's one way to solve the problem. But let's go one wider. Nowadays, since we can use genomics tools, which are these really fancy ways of looking at all the genes in a plant at the same time, it makes us open that bottleneck a little bit. That over time we've narrowed it, and now we're seeing it opening because we can use these tools to accelerate breeding. And so if you're interested in this area, which maybe you are you interested in plants and plant breeding and genetic improvement?
Well, in general, in the field of biotechnology, personally more so on the human side, but it is a point of interest.
Yeah, just because you look like you might be a student, I was going to recruit you. I think the idea here is that, and this is true for everybody, if you want a great paying job in the future, get into plant breeding and plant genetic improvement. Not necessarily genetic engineering, but this idea of crossing plants and using our modern genomics tools to produce better, higher quality products, it's going to be an exploding area in the next 10 years. And I think that if that you decided to switch from humans to plants, you might be the next Bill Gates. So think about it real hard and let me know how I can help you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Tradition has it that the last question belongs to the man who makes all this possible. So, Lauren.
Okay. One question comes to mind here is we've talked a lot about how humans have engaged in various forms of genetic modification over the years, from the early days of plant domestication through modern technology. But in terms of what does nature do? From what I understand of nature, genetic modification is kind of wild in nature. When you look at bacteria, viruses, and other organisms, they cross genes like Topsy, and there's literally hundreds of trillions of them doing this constantly. What do you think about the genetic Wild West in nature?
That's another important point, is how is nature shaping our genetic solutions? Look at citrus greening disease, where we had citrus trees that were resistant to other types of mundane diseases that citrus would get, that now has this new trick that nature has evolved that we can't seem to catch up with. But this is why genetic engineering is so important, is because nature will always be throwing us a curveball, whether it's for human health, whether it's for animal health, whether it's for plants. We're always going to see evolution in action. It's always going to be presenting new challenges. What we need as humans are the most agile, rapid ways to respond to those threats. And whether it's moving a single gene, whether it's using a different kind of fertilizer, whether it's using a different kind of crop at a different time of year, we need to be using all of our tools to be able to push back against nature. We did it last night with vaccines, and we're doing it again here with plants and the evolution of plants and how humans are just facilitating that next generation of rapid evolution faster than the challenges.
I'd just like to make a comment in reference to this afternoon's happenings that Kevin referred to, about the cancellation of his interview on CBC because of some emails that came in accusing him of being a Monsanto shill. And because of that, CBC said they were not comfortable having him do an interview. This, to me, is unbelievable that this can happen. Even if he really were a Monsanto shill, why would you not want to interview him on the technology that exists? And if someone were indeed working for a biotech company such as Monsanto and comes up with some interesting research, they would not be interviewed because Monsanto is regarded unjustly as the devil. So as you can imagine, we are not going to let this lie because this is just unacceptable. The CBC has often criticized Prime Minister Harper for quote, muzzling Canada scientists. Well, is this not in the same category or even worse? If any of you have any ideas, I mean, we have some ideas on how to approach this, but if any of you have any other ideas on how you think we should step in and handle this, happy to hear about that. Also very happy to hear about any suggestions that you might have for upcoming symposia, because indeed the topics that you heard in the last 2 days here were suggested by you guys after I made a plea last year. So give us your thoughts. You can email it in, and you know, my email is easy, it's joe.schwartz@mcgill.ca. Whatever ideas you have, we will certainly consider it. And we'd like to thank our speakers, Brian Ward and Paul Offit yesterday, and Kevin Folta and Jeff today, for really bringing light to some very, very controversial topics. And whether you agree or not, I think we can all agree that you have a better understanding of what the controversies are all about. We also, of course, would like to thank McGill University for making all of this possible, and obviously Laurent Trottier for his general support, not only of the symposium, but in general of and not even only of McGill, but hospitals, foundations of all kinds, and it is... money being put to very, very good use. And of course, thank you for coming. And certainly send me your emails, comments, criticisms, whatever. We're happy to hear them. So far, nobody has asked for my emails, but that may be around the corner. So be careful with the words that you put in there. And hopefully we will see you next year.
Got to get through it one time without having a problem. It's just been such a... It's been a-